Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Ksubas Daf Nun Beis. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara Marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our home page, and go to option 2. If you are already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief formatted introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf Gemara before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins from the second line from the bottom of Daf Nun Aleph Omid Beis. We are in the middle of a discussion concerning the Tanai Ksuba, specifically the issue of the husband's obligation to redeem his captive wife. On the side of the Gemara, we have a Nosei Klali, a general topic heading that reads that this lasts until Nun Beis Omid Beis, Pidyon Ishto Shinish Beis, the redemption of one's wife who was taken captive. And as we go into the Gemara, we'll notice a crown shape, and under our Nosei Mivneh heading, the crown shape appears, featuring a Machlokas Abaye V'Rova, Balmonolukin Godol, a Kohen Godol who married, albeit improperly or illegally, he married a widow, a type of woman that a Kohen Godol is not supposed to marry. He did so. Im Yeshlo Chiyuv Lifdosa, does he have an obligation to redeem her if she is taken into captivity? Labaye Chayev, according to Abaye, he is obligated. The Efshur Lekayimba, because through in her case, he is able to fulfill the original condition written into the Ksuba, which says that in the case of a woman married to a Kohen who's taken captive, since there is a chashash, since there is the fear that she was raped, and a wife of a Kohen was raped, cannot continue living with him anyway. The condition that is stated in the Ksuba with regard to wives of Kohanim is ahadrinoch lemedintoch. I will redeem you from captivity and send you back to your community, to your home, to your father's house, if you will. So since it's possible to fulfill that requirement, even though without her being taken captive, she was already prohibited to be with the Kohen Gadol, but her so that her being taken into captivity isn't essentially the reason that she's being sent home. She should be sent home anyway. But since we're going to be able to fulfill the original condition regarding ransoming or freeing, redeeming one's wife from captivity, according to the original language of the condition that you find by Kohen wives, namely Adrinoch Lebedintoch. So in this case too, the husband, in this case a Kohen Gadol, was obligated to redeem his wife, the Almona. LeRava, according to Rava though, Eino Chayov, he is not obligated to redeem her. Me'achar de'isura Eino Machmas Hashavia, her prohibition to be with her husband, the Kohen Gadol, is not a prohibition that is rooted in the fact she was taken captive. It's rooted in the fact that he violated the halach and married a woman he shouldn't have married. So according to Rava, only when the continued coexistence with her husband, the Kohen, is a function of the captivity, then the Kohen husband is obligated to redeem her. But if her continued coexistence, cohabitation with the Kohen is something that's other than the mere fact she was taken into captivity, then according to Rava, the husband has no obligation to redeem her. Now, with that lengthy introduction in mind, we turn to the Gemara. Second line from the bottom of Nun Aleph Omid Beis, Uvekehenes Ahadrinoch Lemedintoch V'chulei. The condition written into the ksuba, the Tanai ksuba regarding redemption of wives, of Kohen wives, is now that you are redeemed from captivity, I redeem you to send you home because I can't continue living with you because, as we said before, of the chashash of Ones having taken place, of her having been raped by the captors, thereby rendering her forbidden to the kahuna. Omar Abaye, Almona L'Kohen Gadol, Chayov L'Fdosa. A widow who married a Kohen Gadol. Notice that this is also underlined and number one of the examples Abaye will feature on the top of Nun Beis Manav. There's another case, but in the meantime, the widow to the Kohen Gadol, if she, the Almona, is taken into captivity, he has to redeem her. One of the husband's obligations toward his wife, Shani Korei Ba, I refer to her the language, the text of her ksuba, which is uvekehenes, in the case of a kehenes, ahadrinoch lemedintoch. I redeem you to send you home, which is what would have been the case even if it wasn't an almona to a Kohen Gadol, any wife of a Kohen taken into captivity. So the original condition of Adrinoch Limedintoch is still applicable. We continue at the top of Nun Beis Amud Aleph, Mamzeres Unasinu LiYisrael. Here you have a forbidden marriage, and here to a Yisrael, to a general Yisrael, not to a Kohen. These are women that he should not have married, and he did, and then they're taken into captivity. They upon this marriage, there's a Tanai Ksuba, there's a Ksuba with the various conditions that are written in the case of a Yisrael wife that's taken into captivity in general, the condition that appears is that I redeem you and take you back as my wife. In this case, he's not supposed to do that, though. So, Eino Chayov Livdosa, the Yisrael who married the Mamzeres, an illegitimate child, a woman, she was born out of illegitimacy, or Nesina, a type of woman who comes from a people whose conversion to Judaism wasn't really accepted, and she, in an illegal fashion, married a Yisrael. If she's taken into captivity, does not have to redeem her. Eino chayv liftoso she'ena ni korei bo. Because the condition that accompanies redemption is Ve'os vinoch li linto, and I will take you back as my wife. He's not supposed to do that in this case. So Abaye says that he does not have to redeem her. Rava Omar. By the way, on that point of Mamzeres to see Israel, you'll see there's no argument between Abaye and Rava. Rava Omar. Kol she'isur shvia goreim lo chayav lefdosa. Any situation where the captivity is that which results in her prohibition to continue with her husband, only the fact that she was taken into captivity, that's what causes her to be prohibited to continue with her husband, then the husband is obligated to redeem her. However, Isur Dover Acher Goreim Lo, if the prohibition to be with her husband is a function of something else, Eino chayav livdosa, then he does not have to redeem her. So if you take, for example, the case of Almona L'Kohen Gadol, her prohibition of being with him is not a function of the captivity into which she was taken, but rather it's because the Kohen Gadol is not to marry an Almona. So it's on this very point that Abaye and Rava argue, the Almona Kohen Gadol case. If, however, you take a look at the Mamzeres Unasinu L'Yisrael case, there's no argument. That's between Abaye and Rava. Abaye said he does not have to redeem her, and Rava will agree. In the Mamzeres and Nesina to Yisrael case, he will not have to redeem her. The Rashi, we'll look at together, goes over these points. Rava Omar on the fourth line from the top, and Mamzeres Abaye regarding that case, the Mamzeres or Nesina married to Yisrael, Rava agrees with Abaye, the lo ishtabed law. He is not bound to her, to see to it that she's redeemed. Avol be'almono le'kohen gadol poligole. But in the case of the widow married to a kohen gadol, Rava argues with Abaye v'Omar, and he says me'ikora lo ishtabit le'kohenes v'hadrinoch le'medintoch ela machmas she'osro hashivuyo olav. At the outset, the kohen's obligation to redeem her from captivity is only because it's the captivity that created their continued togetherness forbidden. But if she is prohibited to be with him for some other reason, then the husband is not obligated from the outset to redeem her. The conditions behind the extra legal conditions that are understood as part of the ksuba, whether it's Yisrael or Kohen, are the same. It's just that in the case of the Kohen, we go one step further, that it's understood that if she is taken into captivity and as a result of the captivity she becomes also to continue with her Kohen, the husband, she won't lose out from the right to expect his redeeming her. Now, as we go on in the Gemara, we have a topic heading. We call this a hemshech, nosei, hemshech, a continuation. Nisoyon la'amid machlokes abayev arova kemachlokes tanoyim. The Gemara is going to open up with a long question, an attempt to set up the machlokes abayev and rova as paralleling an earlier machlokes tanoyim. And then we will, udechi yosa, the Gemara will reject that attempted paralleling. We're going to be using a geometric form under our Mivneh heading. You can see we have a trapezoid or volcano shape. We call this a ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of a give and take back and forth style Gemara, with the narrow part facing up that represents Kushos questions or difficulties, and the inverted shape indicates tshuvos, responses. You'll notice that as you skim down the page, that each one of these questions and answers appears as a rather long marking. So we open up with a suggestion, a question, Leimo Ketanoi. Can we say that the Machlokes Abayin Rova is a Machlokes Tanoyim? The source begins, Hamadiris Ishto V'nishbeis, a man forswore benefit from his wife, namely that his wife cannot benefit from him, and then she was taken into captivity. Rebbe Elazar Omer Pode V'nosein Lo Subasa. He is to redeem her, even though he's going to have to divorce her because of the nether. He's not going to be able to continue living with her. In effect, he's not going to be able to take her back, but he nevertheless is obligated to redeem her. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Noisein log subasa ve'eino podeh. He gives her the ksuba, but he does not redeem her. This needs quite a bit of explanation, but in the meantime we must move on in order to just see the initial attempt of the Gemara. So we continue. Amar Rabbi Nosson, Shalti is Sumchus. I asked of Sumchus, that's the name of one of the Tanoim. Kishomar Rabbi Yeshua, Noisein Lo Ksubasavenu Poide. When Rabbi Yeshua ruled that he gives her the Ksuba and does not redeem her, Keshidiro Lubasov Nishbeis, oi, even Bishanishbeis Lubasov Hidiro. Is that a case where he made the vow and then she was taken captive? Or even if she was taken captive and then made the vow? So that's the question in terms of order of events. Rabbi Nosson wanted to know what is the story behind Rabbi Yeshua. If we just glance together at Rashi, O benishbeis ulebesof hedira, klomar o afilu kishenishbeis Would Rabbi Yoshua have said his din then as well, that he's not obligated to redeem her? Even though there's room to say, that the only reason he forswore granting her benefit was just to get out of his obligation to redeem her. The Gemara continues, V'omar li, and Sumchus answered me, says Rabbi Nosson, lo shamati, I didn't hear about that. V'nirin dvarim shedira l'besof nishbeis. And it seems to me that Rabbi Shua said his din, if he first had forsworn benefiting her, and then she was taken into captivity. The Amr is nishbeis l'besof hedira, if you would say that Rabbi Yeshua said his halacha, that he doesn't have to redeem her, even if she were taken first captive, and then he made the neder, osila rume, he's going to be underhanded. In other words, he's going to use her captivity as an excuse to forswearing benefit from her. Now, this source has been stated, and we want to make an assumption, my love, B'madir, Eshes, Kohen, Komiflugi, that we're dealing with a man who's a Kohen who's married to a lady, and the man, the Kohen, had made a neder not to benefit her. The original neder that she shouldn't receive any benefit from him. The Abaye, the Omar, Rabbi Lezer. And if you set up the Machlokis, Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Yeshua, as that, then it would come out that Abaye, that said he's obligated to redeem, matches the opinion of Rabbi Lezer. Remember, Abaye said that when you're dealing with an anxious Kohen, even if the reason for his inability to take her back is not rooted in the captivity, like in this case, it's rooted in the fact that he made a neder. He made a vow not to allow her to benefit from him. That's called an Isur Dover Acher. That even if his inability to take her back is a result of some outside prohibition, the Kohen is still obligated to redeem her. And that is what Abaye also said. So Abaye would parallel Rabbi Lezer. The Rava said that in the case of an Almona L'Kohen Godol, since he couldn't take her back anyway, he's not obligated to redeem her. The Omer Rabbi Yeshua, he would then seem to parallel Rabbi Yeshua, who said that the Kohen, who made a neder not to benefit his wife, does not have to redeem her. The Gemara responds, Loi, that's not the analysis. In other words, the way we set things up to make Abaye and Rava parallel Reb Lozer and Reb Yeshua, that's not so. Hocha b'mayaskinon, here, what are we really talking about? Kagon shenodra ihi v'kayem lo hu. It's not that the husband took the net, made the netter. She made a netter. She made a netter that she does not want to grant any benefit to her husband. And he substantiated the nether. Kayim lo, he seconded it, he backed it up. Everyone knows that when a wife takes a nether, the husband has the option of absolving it, of canceling it. It's called, he may fear the nether. That's the case in which Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua are arguing. Now, Rashi gives a little more background. So if we look together at the Rashi, Hocha b'mayaski, and Klomar, Li'oilom Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Yeshua lav v'vugda d'abay v'rov pligi. These Atanoyim are not arguing along the lines of Abay and Rova. V'yib yisr dover acher shalaya de neder, if the issue was some type of outside prohibiting factor that's not vow related, Inami b'kohenes ayadei neder, or in the case of a Kohen's wife being taken into captivity, and there's also a vow, the kule alma, all of them, Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua, ikabaya, ikarova, they would agree either with Abaya or Rova. Here, it's a very specific situation where she made a vow and the husband substantiated it. Shomar Yiskayim, how did he substantiate it? Either by his saying, Beferu, she said explicitly, yes, I second the vow, or he remained silent on the day that she vowed, and the day went by, and he had not said anything. Ubisrael, pligi. The machlokes between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shua concerns a Yisrael. The time of Rabbi Yeshua, who said in this source where the wife of a Yisrael had vowed and he substantiated it, and Rabbi Yeshua said he doesn't have to redeem her, the Kosovar, he knows less of Shinel, she put her finger in her mouth and bit it. Klomar, he gormo liatzmo levatil tano. She brought it on herself. She caused herself to lose out on the condition stated in the Ksuba, obligating a husband to redeem his wife. She'ein ani yochol likros b'Yisrael. She caused it now that I can't fulfill the condition in the Ksuba, v'os v'noch li'into, that I will take the husband, proclaimed I will take you back as a wife. But now she's preventing him from fulfilling that because she took the vow. It's true that the husband seconded it, but she initiated the problem. There's a certain figurative speech that you see here, dealing with the finger and someone biting it, but for our purposes, Rabbi Elazar is saying that he is the one that is responsible for the vow to be a vow, insofar as his obliteration of the vow, is non-canceling of the vow. And therefore, he is the one responsible for the maintenance of the vow. It's his problem, so to speak, and he has to redeem her, because without his creating the problem, he would have been able to take her back as a wife. So now we turn back to the Gemara. Notice the volcano shape repositions itself, narrow part up. We now raise a question. Ihi nosna etzba bein shinea, if she, through her taking the vow not to benefit the husband, is the one that is responsible, then ksuba mai avidita. What's the right that she has to receive a ksuba? Now, if you notice in the source, we have a little arrow to the immediate left-hand side of the mortex. You can align this with the arrow above. At that point, Rabbi Yeshua said she gets a ksuba. But if she's vowing not to benefit her husband, why should she get the ksuba? The Gemara continues, Vesu, and furthermore, here we have a quote from the source, Om Rabbi Nosson, Shalti esumchis kishom Rabbi Yeshua noisein lo ksuba ve'napoide kishadir v'sof nishbeis o b'shenishbeis v'sof adira v'yomar lo shomati. Rabbi Nosson told us that he had asked Sumchis concerning Rabbi Shua's din, what was the order of events, and Sumchis said, I didn't hear. If it's a case where she initiated the vow, Mali Hadira Lebesof Nishbeis, Mali Nishbeis Lebesof Hadira, what difference does it make regarding the order of events, whether the vow preceded the captivity or the captivity preceded the vow? Rashi says a few lines down from here, Mali Hadira Lebesof Nishbeis, Holo herim midi. The husband wasn't dealing in a tricky fashion. Sharei he hischila v'neder. She's the one that started taking the vow. So what difference to make? Remember when we were learning the source, we said that the order of events has relevance regarding the possibility of maybe the husband, after she was taken into captivity, so then he vowed in order to get out of his obligations. But that's not relevant if you say she is the one that initiated the vow. So that explanation of her having initiated a vow is a difficult explanation. Elo, notice we come to back with a response to that. Elo liolom diadro ihu. And we go back to what we said earlier. And that means that we're talking about a case of him having taken the vow. he made a vow not to benefit her, and it was within that that Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua had their argument. And as far as Abaye and Rava are concerned, if you recall, we brought in the Machlokas Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua in order to parallel their Machlokas to Abaye and Rava. No. Here the Gemara says they, Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua, arguing about her, around the husband's having taken the vow. The Abaye metaretz letame, the Rava metaretz letame. Each one, Abaye and Rava, will explain the Tanoim according to their, meaning Abaye and Rava's, own respective approaches. Just to review, Abaye's approach was that in the case of the Almona L'Kohen Gadol, even though there's an outside restrictive factor, he, the Kohen, is nevertheless obligated to redeem her because he wasn't going to take her back anyway. Rava disagreed on that point. The Rava saying that in the case of Almona L'Kohen Gadol, only if it's a captivity-based reason for his inability to take her back does he have an obligation to redeem her. But if it's not a captivity-based restriction, then Rava says the Kohen doesn't have an obligation to redeem her. We already noted that there's a long answer marking here, and we pointed out that Abaye and Rava, each one, explain according to their own approaches. Just structurally, you'll see that you see the squiggle underline expression Abaye Metaretz Letame, and this is Abaye's presentation of his opinion, and then at the end of his presentation, you'll notice we've underlined the names Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Shua, where he features what point they are arguing about. And then Rava appears later, you can see again squiggle underline, where he presents his opinion on this matter with his presentation of the Machlokes Tanoim. So now the Gemara. After saying Abaye Metaretz Letamei, Rava Metaretz Letamei, Abaye Metaretz Letamei, Almona L'Kohen Gadol, Kule Alma, Lo Pligi, Dechayev Livdosa. This, of course, is Abaye's point of view, and hence he will tell you that all the Tanoim, Rabbi Eliezer and Yeshua, will all agree that the Kohen is obligated to redeem her. And as far as Abaye is concerned, the reason for that is because he wasn't, the Kohen wasn't going to take her back anyway. The fact that she happens to also be because she's an Almona to a Kohen Gadol, that doesn't bother Abaye from the husband's obligation to still redeem her. The Rashi on this point, the Chayav Lifdoisa, Sharei ani korei bo, I still refer to her bein betchilas hatnai bein besoif kiyumo, whether at the beginning of things or at the end of things. Vadrinoch lemedintoch, I'm sending you home. I'm going to redeem you to send you home. V'afagav yisur dover acher goram lo, even though it's an outside prohibition that's causing this to be, i.e., the Kohen Gadol married a woman he shouldn't have married. Hadrinoch lemedintoch hu, it's still a fulfillment of that aspect of the ksuba, which said that a wife of a Kohen taken to captivity is going to be sent home. So she's going to be sent home, regardless of the fact that even at the outset of their marriage, she should have been sent home. So that's the first point. A second point, we go back to the Gemara. Mamzeres Nusi Yisrael, as far as Abaye is concerned, a Yisrael who married these forbidden women, Kule Almo, Lo Pligi Dieno, Chayav Livdoisa. The Tanoim, all Tanoim will agree, the husband does not have to redeem her. Because when you're dealing with the Yisrael, he was supposed to, the condition was, upon redemption, I'm taking you back. Here, in this case, he can't take her back. He's forbidden to take her back. So the condition can't be fulfilled. The condition, when we speak about the condition, we're speaking about the condition written in the Ksuba regarding the laws and expectations of husband's redeeming of wife. Madir Eishes Kohen. Nami Kuliamolo Pligi Dechayev Livnosa. A Kohen who vowed not to benefit his wife. When they got married, the ksuba contained a statement that if she's taken into captivity, he'll redeem her and send her back home. Now that he took the vow, the same thing. He's going to have to send her away. So as far as Abaye is concerned, even though there's now a factor that is other than the captivity issue, there's the vow issue, but since the original condition remains unchanged, i.e. Kohen redeeming captive wife is sent home, so he has to redeem her. Dahainu almona l'kohen gadol. This basically is the same form as the case of the almona l'kohen gadol. If we look at the Rashi, ma dirashis kohen nami, kohen shehidiris ishto nami, a kohen who forswore granting benefit to his wife as well, shetnai horishon, the original condition, vadrinach lemedintach, who? I'm going to redeem you to be sent home. It is that. V'efshu lo lochu b'shasa t'nai, v'efshu lo l'kaimo b'sofo. That is, it's possible to set in at the beginning, when they got married, and at the end as well. Chayav l'vdoisa, he has to redeem her. Dahainu ke'almona l'kohen gadol. This is the same format as the kohen gadol who married the almona. So that as well, just like Abaye mentioned, Almona Kohen Gadol, there's no machlokas tanoim. So too in Madir Eishes Kohen, there is no machlokas tanoim. So what we have listed by way of markings, cases Aleph, Beis, and Gimel, are all cases of no machlokas. Keep Ligi, when does a machlokas tanoim arise? The Madir Eishes Yisrael. A non-Kohen married a woman, and then he made a vow not to grant her benefit. And then the woman is taken into captivity. When they marry, could the condition have been fulfilled? Yes. Now, after they've been married and he made a vow, and then she's taken into captivity, can the condition of taking her back be met? No. Rabbi Eliezer, who said that the husband is obligated to redeem her, Ozil Boser Meikora, he looks at things as they were at the outset. When they got married, had she been taken into captivity, at that moment he would have been able to redeem her and taken her back, as the condition in the Ksuba states. It's true that, well, she wasn't taken into captivity immediately, but as time went on, he made a vow not enabling her to receive any benefit from him, and as a result of that, he'll have to divorce her and not take her back. But nevertheless, the fact that she was taken into captivity doesn't change things as far as his original obligation to redeem her. Rabbi Yeshua, on the other hand, Ozil Boser Besof, he looks at things at the time of redemption, at the end. And at the time of redemption, he had already taken the vow. And as a result of that, as a result of things now, he isn't going to be able to be taking her back. And as a result of that, he doesn't have an obligation to redeem her. Because the redemption was only with the condition of his taking her back. We continue in the Gemara. Rava mitaretz the tamei. Rava, who did pay attention to outside preventive factors, is going to explain the machlokas tanoim according to his point of view. Almona l'kohen gadol, mamzeres unasi Yisrael. In both of these cases, kule alma lo pligi di'eno chayav levdosa. All the tanoim will agree that he is not obligated to redeem her. If we take a look at Rashi toward the end of the narrow line, second to last narrow line, the Eino Chayav Lefdosa, Almona, he doesn't have to redeem her. Sheina Nikorei Bo Adrinoch Lemedintoch Mach Mashvia. The sending of her back home as a result of captivity is not the case. It's not as a result of the captivity. Ela machmas dovar achir. It's because of the prohibition of a kohen gadol having married an almona. Umamzeres, also no obligation to redeem. Sheina nikorei bavos vinoch leintu. There was never a point in time at which that condition could have been fulfilled. Keep ligi. When will a machlokes, Reb Elazar and Reb Yeshua arise? Bemadir, well, with the vow example, bein eishes kohen, bein eishes Yisrael. As far as Rava is concerned, the eishes kohen, meaning a kohen had vowed not to benefit his wife, and Yisrael likewise. This will be a machlokas, and this is the point of difference between Rava and Abaye. Is the case of the Ashes Kohen. As far as Abai was concerned, that was not a point of controversy. Abai said, in the case of the Ashes Kohen and the Madir Ashes Kohen, everyone agreed there is an obligation. Not as far as Rova is concerned. With Madir Ashes Kohen, this is a machlokes. Reb Elazar Ozil Boser Meikor. Reb Elazar, who said that the husband is chayav to redeemer, he looks at things as they were at the outset. In other words, prior to the vow, then the original conditions respectively would have been met, that the kohen would redeem her to send her home because of the shviyah. There wasn't a vow at that point, and the Eishes Yisrael, he would have been able to take her back. And Reb Elazar looks at things as they were at the beginning. Reb Yeshua, Ozil Baser Basof. Reb Yeshua says there's no obligation because he looks at things as they were, as time went on, at the end, at the time of redemption. At the time of redemption, the Kohen, if he had made a vow not to benefit his wife, he wasn't going to take her back because of a reason other than the captivity issue, rather because of the vow. And as far as Rabbi Yeshua is concerned, that's enough reason to cancel the husband's obligation of redeeming her. The Rashi spells all of this out. We can look at it together. Toward the end of the page, Ki pligi b'madir bein eishes kohen, d'meikar b'shas atnai, at the time they got married, karinon bay, we would have referred the condition v'adrinoch Machmas Shvia, her being sent home to her community as a result of the captivity. Ubasof, Iko, Yisur Davar Achir. But as time went on, there was an additional reason for her being sent home, namely the neder, the vow. V'chein b'madir Eishes Yisrael, Meikor Karin Bo, before the vow, I would have referred her situation as Velsvinoch Lintu, I'll take you back as a wife. Ubasof, Lo Karin Bo, and at the end, when the vow had been taken, that wouldn't have been able to be fulfilled. And as we saw, Reb Elazar looks at things as they were at the beginning, and therefore there is an obligation to redeem. And Reb Yeshua looks at things as they were as time went on. And through Rava's eyes, when you look at things at times as time went on, we are going to give emphasis to outside preventive factors as well. We continue in the Gemara. Nishbeis chayav levdosu v'chulei. On the side of the Gemara we have a topic heading. Nishbeis b'chayav b'ayla. A woman, married woman, was taken into captivity while her husband was still alive. V'achakach meis b'ayla. And while she's in captivity, her husband dies. Hayim ha'yorshim chayovim levdosu. Are the heirs obligated to redeem the woman who's now a widow? Tana Rabbanan, Nishbeis b'chayav b'ayla, v'achakach meis b'ayla. Woman was taken into captivity while her husband was still alive, and then he died while she was in captivity. Hikir bo b'ayla, if her husband before he died became aware of her being in captivity, then Yorshin Chayovim Levdoisa. Then the heirs, the people that inherit their father, have to redeem their father's wife. It's as if they by the husband becoming aware, so that creates the obligation for her to be redeemed, even if he's not around at that time, at the time that the redemption would take place. Lo hikir bo by law, if the husband never became aware of her having been taken into captivity, ein yorshim chayovim livdosa, then the heirs are not obligated to redeem her. Levi sovar lemevad uvda ki ha masnisa. Levi had an intention to rule. Mevad uvda is to act accordingly, to rule in a practical case, in an actual case based on this source. Omerle Rav. Rav tells Levi, Hochi Omar Habibi. Habibi is Rabbi Chiya, his uncle, Rav's uncle. Les hilchaso ki ha masnisa. The halacha does not follow that source. Eloki ha desanya. The halacha follows rather the following source, and you'll see as we go on there is a point of difference. The source reads: Nishbeis lachar misas baylo ein hayisam chayavim livdoisa. A widow who is taken into captivity, so the heirs do not. The heirs, in other words, those who inherited her husband's estate, his heirs do not have to redeem her. Not only that, but even if she was taken into captivity while her husband was still alive, and while she's in captivity, the husband dies, the Yesomim are not obligated to redeem her, even if the husband had become aware of her being in captivity while he was alive, because I can't fulfill. With the husband dead, you can't fulfill the clause of Os Vinoch Lintu, I will take you back as my wife. He's dead. Therefore, since that clause, the redemption leading to his taking her back, cannot be fulfilled, so there's no redemption. Obviously she has money she gets from the Ksuba, and of course our hope is that she'll be able to use that to redeem herself, but we can't turn to the heirs and expect them to shell out money for her redemption. We continue. We also want to note a topic heading on the side. Pidyon ishto shenishbeis b'yoysu michtei domeha. The redemption of one's wife who was taken into captivity at a rate more than her value. There's a concept of a person's value. If let us say they were to be sold as a slave in the slave market, how much would a person pay for that individual? So that is what we would say is their value. There might be more to say on that particular topic, but we're just going to work with this given that a person has what's called kidei domo. The Gemara, Tonu Rabbona, Nishbeis Vayumavakshin Mimenu Arasora B'Domeah. A wife was taken into captivity, and they turned to the husband with a request to ransom her for 10 times, up till 10 times her value. Pam Rishona Podet. Well, the first time it happens, he redeems her. Mikan Velech Rotsa Poida Rotsa Poida. Beyond that, if he wants to again pay for her redemption, he can. If not, not. The Rabbonon, in establishing husband's obligation to redeem, it's only a one-time obligation. And if she's taken into captivity again, so then it's a matter of his personal choice. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, we continue at the top of Omid Beis. Ein poidin es hashvuyin yoyser al kadei demehen. Mipnei tikun ha'olam. This is a very well-known opinion, and unfortunately, the Jewish people, I'm sure those who are listening to this recording at this point in time, are aware of the actuality of this situation. The issue of, we, according to Shimon Leah, we do not redeem captives at more than their value. And he said, and because mipnei tikkun ha'olam, Rashi says at the top, mipnei tikkun ha'olam, shelo yargilu la'alois al damam, so as not to encourage captors to constantly raise the ransom demanded. The Gemara then notes, Ha b'chdei demehen podin. The inference is, though, that if the ransom requested is in accordance with the captive's value, we do redeem them. Even though the amount demanded, or even though their actual value is an amount more than the ksuba, v'raminhi, we raise a contradiction then to this from the following source. Nishbeis v'yimavakshim mena ad asor b'ksubasa. A woman was taken into captivity and they asked for her ransom up till 10 times the value of her ksuba. Pamrishona poide, the first time, so the husband is to redeem her. Mikan v'elech, beyond that, rotze poide, rotze no poide. If he wants to, he can. If not, not. Rav Shmuel Omer, imhoya pirkone keneged ksubasa poide. If the ransom is an amount corresponding to her ksuba, then the husband will redeem her. Im lav, eino poide. However, if the amount is more than the ksuba, he will not have to redeem her. So, what if we just focus on Shulam Leo for the time being? According to the inference from the first source, if the ransom is in accordance with her market value, even though that might be more than the ksuba, the husband has to redeem her. According to Shulam Leo in the second source, if the ransom value is more than the ksuba, he does not redeem her. The Gemara says there isn't a contradiction here, rather, trei kuli is lay. Rabbi Shimon Leal has two leniencies vis-a-vis the husband. And what are the two leniencies? He will not have to pay more than her market value, nor more than her the amount of her ksuba. We continue with another one of the marriage obligations, the ksuba obligations. Loksa chayav l'raposa. If the wife takes ill, the husband has to pay the medical expenses. Tonu Rabbonan. Before we continue, let's just glance at the side. We have a nosei topic heading. Dine tashlumin le'almona le'tzorche refuasa. Laws regarding the payment for an almona's medical expenses. We'll see a distinction made between refuah sheyesh lo kitzba, a medical expense that has a fixed amount. You can say it, for example, there are certain types of operations that a person needs, and there's a fixed amount how much the operation will cost. And then there's refuah she'ein lo kitzva. That's a situation where there's ongoing medical expenses. There's no fixed amount assigned to it. So now we continue with the source, Tana Rabbanan. Almona nizonis minichse yisom. And this is one of the conditions that is written into the ksuba, that when a woman becomes an almona, it means her husband died, leaving her a widow. She remains in her house, and she derives her maintenance, her food expenses from the estate. So this is a pretty well-known point, that almona nizonis minichse yisayimim. She is supported from the properties inherited by the orphans. Utsricha refuah harehi kimazonos. And an almona that needs medical expenses, she is that is viewed like mazonos. Rabba Shmuel Omer refuah sheyesh lo kitzva nisrapis miksubasa. If it's a medical expense that has a kitzva, a fixed amount, then it's not considered like mizonos. It's not considered like food, and the payment for that is miksubasa. It's deducted from the value of the ksuba that an almona is paid. She'ein lo kitzva, if it's medical expenses that don't have a fixed amount to them, harehi kimizonos, then it's like her food support. Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Osu Hakosas Dam Beretz Yisrael, Kirifur She'ein Lo Kitzva. Hakosas Dam is bloodletting, a very well-known medical procedure, very common at the time of the Talmud, and some practice it to this day. So that Hakosas Dam in Eretz Yisrael was viewed as a refuah shein lo kitzvah, hence it has mizonos status. Kreve de Rabbi Yochanan, Have Luhu, Itzis Abba, there were relatives of Rabbi Yochanan that happened to have that inherited an estate, and their father had left a widow. Itzis Abba means a wife of their father. Dahavis Tzricha Rufua Koyoimo, she needed daily medical care, and that cost money. Also, Kame to Rabbi Yochanan. Apparently, it was costing them because she was drawing from the estate that they inherited. We said mizonos is the way we look at refuah shein lo kitzvah, and here you have a woman that was drawing from their estate, and they came to their relative Rabbi Yochanan. Omar lahu. So Rabbi Yochanan said to them, he gave them a piece of advice. He said, "Izilu kotsu la midi lerefuah." Rashi says, "Kotsu le midi lerefua, shikabel olav refuasa olamis bekach bekach." In other words, tell your relative that he should accept upon himself her refua. I will accept, let's say, a certain amount of money to cover her medical expenses. And then Rabbi Yochanan said, and by doing that, by establishing a fixed amount for her medical needs, the medical needs will not be viewed anymore as mizonos, and it will be paid from her ksuba. Then a second stage of events takes place. Omar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan regrets that he had given them this advice. Asinu atzmenu ke'orchei hadayonim. Rabbi Yochanan says, we made ourselves to be like Orche HaDayonim. Rashi explains, Orche HaDayonim, Oyev Echod Mibale Dinim, is someone who shows favoritism to one side in an argument between two litigants. Umat'im Zechuyosov Ladayon, V'Ore Chadin Lifnei HaDayonim Lizchuso. An Orech HaDin, Orche Dayonim, are people that set up the case, the arguments for one of the two sides to make a strong claim in front of the judges. We turn back to the Gemara, and that is something that is we in traditional Jewish law object to. So Orche HaDayonim, people who set up the arguments for one of the sides in a legal argument. So the Gemara wants to know what exactly governed the Rabbi Yochanan's behavior. At first, he gave the one side, the heir's side, a piece of advice, and then he regretted that. Meikora my sovar lebesof my sovar. At the beginning, that he gave the advice to basically save them from paying all those medical expenses. What was Rabbi Yochanan thinking when he said to convert her medical expenses into a fixed amount? And then his regret, what was he thinking? Mei kara sovar. At first, Rabbi Yochanan held, u'mibsorcha lo tesalim. When it comes to your relatives, do not hide yourself. As we said, it was his relatives that were complaining that there had been one of their relatives died, and there was a widow who was drawing from the inheritance for her constant medical expenses. So Rabbi Yochanan said this, my relatives are losing out. A person should not hide himself from his flesh, from his besorcha. His relatives, don't hide yourself. Help them out. But then when he regretted that, he figured, Odom Choshuv Shaini. And when it comes to a person of importance, like himself, like Rabbi Yochanan, it's different. There he has to play neutral, not to appear, as we said before, as one of the Orche Hadayonim. We continue with a new Mishnah, and on the side of the Gemara, you notice we have a Nosei Mivneh heading. There's a house shape that appears and a double underline. These are Tanai Ksuba, different conditions that make up the Ksuba marriage document, the guarantees given to a woman. And Dafilu lo kosvan chayov bohen. Even if these conditions were not written in actuality, he, the husband, is nevertheless bound to them. That they shuhu tanai bezvas. Each one is considered a court-based condition. It's not a personal clause that each husband dreams up and writes in, but rather it's a pre-established court condition. Therefore, even without its appearing in the Ksuba document, it is binding. So as we skim down, we notice you have a house around Bon and Dichrin, a house marking around Benon Nukvin, and number three, V'at is a reference to the Almona herself. So the first condition deals with children that male, Dichrin is the word Zechorim, male children that they have, and the second condition deals with their with girls that they have together, and the third condition deals with the Almona herself. So now the Mishnah. Lo kosav law. A man did not write into the Ksuba the following. We're going to see where the double line underline appears. The next line, chayav shutai beis, is chayav anyway. So what did he not write in? Bonin nuk dichrin deyahavi lichiminoi. The boys that are born through us. When learning this Mishnah, bear in mind that we're dealing with a case of a man that will have two wives at the end of the day, two sets of children. So he tells his wife, he says, he tells one of his wives, he says, and we say one of his wives, I mean, he tells each wife this thing, that the male children that we have together, Inun Yarsun Kesef Ksubosech Yeser Al Chukahin De'imachuhon. That eventually, and we're going to describe a case where the two wives die in the lifetime of their husband. So the husband is telling them that you should know that eventually, after he dies and had inherited his two wives, those properties that each woman brought into the marriage, and I must add, and those items that the husband had dedicated from his own property toward each wife, and they might very well be different amounts, but the each woman is guaranteed that the children that she has with him, each group of children respectively, will inherit that which was written into their own mother's ksuba. So that if we want to present things in a very superficial fashion, without there's much more detail than what I'm going to say now. But if you have Mr. X, the man, is married to woman A and he's married to woman B. With woman A, there was a ksuba value of $100, and with woman B, also a ksuba value of $100. However, with woman A, he produced two sons. With woman B, he produced 10 sons. So the result of Ksuba's Bon and Dikrin says that in the case of the two sons, they're going to be inheriting, as far as their mother's Ksuba, $50 apiece. Because they're only two sons, and their mother's Ksuba total value was $100. Woman 2's Ksuba was also total value of $100, but she produced 10 sons with him, with the husband. Each one will get only $10 apiece. That's a manifestation of this particular clause. As I said, there's much more detail than what I just said, but to give you a feeling of the ramifications of having such a clause in, I think we accomplished that. So even if it's not written in, it's binding because it's a Tanai based in. another clause that is found in Ksubas. Benon nukvin dihavion lichi minoi, the girls that we bear together. Yahavion yasvon bevesi umitzinon minichsi ad tilochen leguvrin. They'll be entitled to stay in the house and derive support from my properties until they are taken by men, until they're married. Again, another example of something that the Gemara will add quite a bit of we'll say, restrictions or qualifications of how this is to be applied. This is also Chayav Shehu Tanai Bezdin. A third clause, Ate Yasve Bevesi Umitzon Minchosai, you will continue living in my house and receiving support from my properties, Kol Yemei Megal Munusech, as long as you are in your state of widowhood, Bevesi. Now the word Bevesi appears in this clause twice. That is a point of importance later on. This clause, even if it's not written in Chayav Shu Tanai Bezdin, Kachoyu Anshe Yerushalayim Kosvin. That which we've seen till now is the text that the people of Yerushalayim used to write. Anshe Golil Hoyu Kosvin Kanshe Yerushalayim. And the people of Golil followed that practice. Now here's another practice. Anshe Yehuda Hayakaisin, the people of the Yehuda region. The Anshe Golil represented the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, and the Anshe Yehuda is the southern part of Eretz Yisrael. They would write, Anshe Yirtzu Hayorshim Lite Loch Subosech. The widow, the lady, will continue living in her husband's house until the heirs decide to pay her suba. Therefore, according to Anshe Yehuda, it seems like the Yorshim, we can say, are in the driver's seat. They can decide, take the ksuba that you were guaranteed at the point of your marriage to our father, and goodbye. The topic at hand is, the opening topic is Ksubas Bonen Dichrin. Now, the Gemara gives us some background to that issue of the husband telling his wife that the male children that we produce, they will get your Ksuba. Don't make any mistake about things. This whole issue is focusing on the women's respective ksubas. If this man dies, leaving additional personal estate funds above and beyond the ksubas of his respective wives, so that property is inherited equally amongst all the sons. We had an example before of 2 sons and 10 sons. That man had 12 sons. The rest of his properties will be split equally amongst each one of his 12 sons. But here we're focusing on the properties that were written into the ksubos of their respective mothers. And as we said here, the Gemara gets into the background to all of this. Omar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochoi. Mipnei ma hiskinu ksubas bonin dichrin. Why was this made as an enactment? After all, a husband inherits his wife. And remember, we said before that this case of ksubas bonin dichrin is predicated on an assumption, or on the case, at least our presentation was, a man had been married to 2 wives, and the 2 women died in his lifetime. When they die, the husband, he inherits whatever properties his wives brought into the marriage. So once that's a given, a husband inherits his wives. Why was there an enactment that the children of each wife will inherit their mother's ksubas respectively, that which their father, in effect, inherited from them, from the women? So why was this established that it's that the ksubas are directed to the separate sets of children? their mothers, their own mothers' tshuva will then be inherited by them. Answer. We want to encourage men, fathers of girls. We want to encourage them that in anticipation of their girls getting married, that they will assign properties, assign wealth to their daughters. And just to read that line again, Kedei Shikvots Odom V'yichtoiv Levito, the Odom here is that we want to encourage a father to write over to his daughter as if she were a son. Uma Umi Iko Midi Derachmon Omar Bro Leirus Bartelo Terus V'osu Rabbonon Umisakni De Terus Barta. Is there anything that could be like this, where so just to review what we've just said, the Gemara pointed out Kidei Shikpoitz Odom V'yichtoiv Levito Kivano, in order to encourage a man to assign to his daughter properties. In order to encourage him to do that, in anticipation of her marriage, a person will do that only if he knows that his grandchildren will ultimately benefit from that. And how do we accomplish that? By letting a person know that the sons that your daughter bears, they will be the ones to inherit those properties that you are now assigning to her. The Gemara asks, "Umiko midi derachmona mabro lirus bartolo terus." Could it possibly be that the Torah says that when a man has sons and daughters, only the sons inherit; daughters do not inherit. The osu rabbonon umesakni, and the rabbonon come along and make a rule or a tikkun, the terus barta. In other words, here we're encouraging a father to give over properties that his sons would have inherited upon his death. And while the father's alive, he's going to be assigning these properties, or some of the properties that his sons would have inherited, to his daughter. So the Gemara says, Honami Doraisahu, this takona is also within the realm of the Torah's concept. How do you figure that? Dichtiv, Khu Noshim Validu Bonim Uvonos, Ukhu Livnechem Noshim Vesbenoisechem Tenu La Noshim. It's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, which is encouraging parents to marry off their children. So the pasuk says, first of all, get married. Have sons and daughters, then take daughters for your sons, and your daughters and your and take wives, that is women, for your sons, and for your daughters give them over to men. So Bishlama Bonim Biyodei Kaimi. I can understand when you're talking about your sons, talking about the male children, it's something within the man's power to get a wife. It's the derech, it's the way of men to seek out their female mate, their spouse. Allah bin say mi kaimen biyode. The pasuk is instructing that that for your daughters you should give your daughters over to men. Is it in a father's power to give his daughter over to some man? The man has to want her. He has to initiate it. What's this idea of a father giving his daughter over to men? So ha komash malon. The pasuk is telling me the following: the nilbisha v'nichsa v'nesiv lo midi, clothe her and give her properties, kihechi de kafsi alo viyosu nasvi lo, so as to serve as an incentive to menfolk to come and seek her out. if the menfolk know that this girl has along with her a bundle of property, it makes her all the more attractive in terms of marriage. So that this idea of encouraging fathers to assign properties to their daughters, even though those very properties are properties that their sons would have inherited, nevertheless, this idea, as you can see, is sanctioned by the scripture as well. The ad kamo, and how much is that when we speak about giving over a father assigning properties to his daughters, how much? Abaye v'rova damri trevayu ad l'isur nichsi, up till a tenth of his possessions, of his properties. As we go on in the Gemara, you notice a series of triangles. On the side of the Gemara, we have a mivneh, structural note, which features a triangle, and we've written Sidra Shel She'elois, a series of questions, Shehem Be'etzem, which are essentially Hatzois Filufiois Ledina Kayim Shel Bonin Dichrin. Essentially, we have suggestions or alternative suggestions to the current understanding, to the current halacha of Bonin Dichrin. So maybe we should just state what the current halacha of Bonin Dichrin is so that we appreciate the questions. The current halacha of Bonin Dichrin states that the respective sets of children from each wife that a man happened to have, when he dies, when the husband dies, so the male children of each one of the wives will inherit their own mother's ksuba, whatever properties her father and the husband had assigned to that particular woman, i.e. their mother, her children, her male children that remain, they will inherit their mother's ksuba. What is their mother's ksuba comprised of? It's comprised of properties that her father, or we call it their maternal grandfather, had assigned to her in anticipation of her wedding, plus properties that the husband had assigned toward her when they were getting married. So that any given man, if he has two or more wives, so there are two sets of children that we're talking about. Each set of children will inherit their mother's ksuba, which, as we said, is comprised of their respective maternal grandfather's dedication plus their own father's dedication toward each one of his wives. And as we said, the amounts will vary, either in the amount that was written into the ksuba or the amount of children that the man produces from each one of his wives. So now the Gemara asks, V'eimah, why not say as follows, De'av Lerus, the properties that the maternal grandfather had dedicated toward his daughter's marriage, that is what is inherited separately by each set of children. Deba'al lo leirus, but what their father had dedicated toward their mothers, the basic suba of monomosayim. That's if the mother was a widow, so it's 100 zuz. If the mothers were virgins when they got married, they were 200 zuz. That amount is not to be inherited by each set of children separately, but rather that would be part of their father's estate and distributed equally amongst all the children. The Gemara says, well, if you're going to take that approach, Im kein av nami mimna velo kosav. If that which the children's father had dedicated toward their mother's marriage will not be inherited separately by each set of children, then the maternal grandfather's would not have, will not assign, they will minimize, withhold, and not assign properties to their daughters in anticipation of the marriage. The Ema, well, let's say as follows. Hecha de kosav av lichtov baal. Why not formulate the halacha like this, that where a father writes a dowry over to his daughter, so then the din of ksubas bonin dikrin will apply, and the father and their own father's ksuba will be inherited by the separate sets of children respectively. However, hecha de lo kosavav lo lichtov baal. But if, let us say, imagine a poor girl gets married, and their fathers don't have what to give over to them, but the husband, he does assign properties to each one of his wives. But since the father didn't assign anything, so then the husband's own ksuba dedications will not be inherited separately by each set of children. The Gemara says, no, lo plug Rabbonin. When the Rabbonin established the halacha of ksubas bonin dichrin, they did it in an unqualified fashion, namely whether or not the maternal grandfather assigns properties to his daughters, the ksuba of each wife will be inherited by their children separately. The Gemara asks, bas bein habonim nami tirus. We take a look at Rashi on the third line under the Gemara. First line under the Gemara text. First wide line of Rashi under the Gemara text. Bas bein on bonim tiros. Kevon de taimo mishum nedunyahu. Hecho de ein lo bonim mimeno. Elo yesh lo bas min hoisha. Achas. Ubonim min hoacheres. Tito bas hayechido ksubas imo lirash nedunyo shenosan avi imo mai shno de tikun bonin dichrin. Imagine a case where the man, the husband, had left two wives, and one of the wives had with him only a daughter, and the other wife had sons. The suggestion here is that regarding the ksuba inheritance, that single daughter that he had with one wife, she should inherit her mother's ksuba. And yet the Mishnah says that no, that this halacha of mother ksuba inheritance is only bonin dichrin, male children. The Gemara answers, Kenachlo shavyua rabbonon. This halacha of ksubas bonin dichrin is formulated along the lines of the rules of Yerusha, Nachla inheritance. And the laws of Yerusha say that when a man dies leaving sons and daughters, the sons inherit, the daughters do not inherit. Question. Bas bein habonos tiros. Well, okay, once you say that the law of ksubas bonin dichrin parallels the laws of Yerusha, the law of Yerusha says that when a man dies leaving no sons, just daughters, then the daughters inherit his property. So that, imagine the following. We're talking about a man who had been married to two wives. From one wife, there was one daughter, and from the other wife, there were several daughters. So why not have the girl who is the only child from her mother, she inherits her mother's ksuba, and the other girls from a woman that produced several daughters, they inherit their mother's ksuba. And yet, we don't say that. The halacha was bonin dichrin. Dichrin meant male children. So why in this case are we not going to distribute the ksubas the way we just suggested? The Gemara says, lo plug rabbonon. The Rabbonan made no distinctions. When they imposed the halacha of ksubas bonin dichrin, they said very simply that female children will not inherit their mother's ksuba. And to be just to be more, let's say, focused in our explanation, just like we said that Bas Bein HaBonim does not inherit, so too Bas Bein HaBonos will not inherit. Continuing in the Gemara, V'tigvi mimetalteli, the concept or the translation of metalteli is portables. If we look in the Rashi, on the, let's say, the fifth wide line of Rashi, V'tigvi mimetalteli, kevon detaimo mishum nedunyas avi ho'em hu. Since the basis of Ksubas Bon and Dikrin is in order to encourage fathers to assign dowries to their mothers, to their daughters, and Rashi makes reference to Avihoim, we're talking about the eventual grandchildren inheriting from their maternal grandfather. Aloma Amrino Leah, why has it been said before? We learned this on Daf Nun. Kishem Shena Bonim Yorshim Elo Mikarka. There was a comment made which was obscure and it had to be explained. Vukimno, and we explained that Biksubas Bonin Dikrin. The institution of Ksubas Bon and Dikrin states that when the father of these two sets of children dies, if he did not leave any real estate, any landed property, even a very small amount, then the halacha of Ksubas Bon and Dikrin will not apply, and all of the value, all of the properties of the respective ksubas will be distributed equally amongst all of his sons. Only if there is real estate that this man leaves above and beyond the value of the respective ksubas, then we allow Ksubas Bon and Dikrin to apply, to kick in. So here the Gemara is asking, following Rashi's explanation, why not allow Ksubas Bon and Dikrin to take place even if there was no real estate left by the husband, but there were portables that were left by the husband. So the Gemara answers, Kiksuva Shavyuha Rabbonon. The law of Ksubas Bon and Dikrin is like the law of the basic Ksuba. Now the law of the basic Ksuba says, Rashi says here, Kiksuba Shavyu Rabbonon, Umetalteli Lasmi Lo Mishtabdi Lishtora. Portables are not portables inherited by orphans are not a source of collection for documents that are left by their father. So if a man owed money and he In his estate, he left only portables that were inherited by his children that are now called the Yasmi, the orphans. So the father's creditors cannot collect from those. And this idea of Ksubas Bon and Dikrin is viewed as that. And therefore, if the father did not leave any land, he left just portables of his own, so then the collection of the Ksubas Bon and Dikrin cannot take place. We continue in the Gemara. Titrof Mimeshabdi. If you're telling me that Ksubas Bon and Dikrin is like the Ksuba, so just like in the case of the basic ksuba, when a man dies leaving a widow, and the man had sold off properties in his lifetime, the widow can go to the purchasers. We call them the mishubodim. She has a lien on them. She can go to them and say, you know, my husband owed me prior to your purchase, he owed me my ksuba, so I'm coming to you for collection of my ksuba. So what the Gemara is suggesting here is allow the respective sets of children to collect their mother's ksuba from properties that the father, who in effect inherited his wives, had in the meantime, while he was still alive, had sold off. So let these heirs, the sons of the respective women go to those purchasers and say, we're here to inherit our mother's ksuba. The Gemara answers, no, we don't do that, because yar sun tnan. The language of the of ksubas bonavikrin is, and you can see this language in the Mishnah itself. If you look back, we have a little arrow to the side of more to the right hand side of the Gemara text. You can see above where the opposite the fourth wide line of the Gemara. You can see that in the original language, the original tnai, the original condition of ksubas bonen dikrin, it said bonen dikrin dihavun lichi minoy inun yarsun. There's the key word yarsun kesik ksubasech yeser achukon dimacheon. The word yarsun is Lord Yerusha, inheritance, and we heirs, when they inherit their father's estate, they inherit that which their father left in his own possession. They don't go to properties that their father had sold during his lifetime. The Gemara continues, V'eimah, why not say, Afal gav deleko moisar dinar? The rule of ksubas bonen dikrin, we alluded to this before in passing, that the two sets of children will inherit their mother's ksubas respectively only if their father, i.e. the husband of these women, had his own property valued at one dinar more than the, or there's one dinar of his own property besides the property written into the ksubas of the respective ladies. Now, dinar is not a lot of money, but there has to be a mosar. Mosar means extra, above and beyond the value of the ksubas that father had of his own properties. If he had mosar dinar of land, then the halach of ksubas bonen dikrin will take place. If not, then, as we said before, all of the two ksubas, if it's two wives, is pulled together and distributed equally amongst all of the sons. So why not say that ksubas bonen dikrin applies even if there is no moser dinar? The Gemara says, "B'mokam dekama akra nachla deraisa lo tokinu rabbonan." In a situation where we'll uproot we'll uproot entirely Yerusha, the laws of inheritance as perceived by the Torah. How does the Torah perceive the laws of inheritance? When a man dies, all of his sons, even if they're from several different women, all of the sons inherit his property equally. Ksubas bonen dikrin is a very unequal distribution of properties. So unless we can show that with regard to some aspect of his estate, there was equal distribution of properties amongst all of his children, if we can't do that, then there's no ksubas bonen dikrin procedure either. And therefore, if we can allow the laws of Yerusha to manifest themselves on that mosar dinar of the father's or husband's own property, then we can say, so to speak, we fulfilled our Torah obligation of Yerusha on that small piece of property, the mosar dinar. And now, as far as the ksubas are concerned, that can be inherited by the separate sets of children respectively, each one inheriting their mother's ksuba. Before we go further in the Gemara, we have a topic heading in Osei, Rav Papa Mechatein Es Beno. Rav Papa is seen in the upcoming story marrying off his son, Umagia Lebeis Avi Hakala, and he arrives at the house of the father of the bride, Lahachin Haksuba Velirshaim Schum Hanedunya, and in the house of the Kala, so the Ksuba will be written up, and they're gonna write into it the amount of the dowry. Yehuda Bar Remar Mislavel Rav Papa, this individual, Yehuda bar Meir, you'll see from the context of the story, is apparently an important individual. He comes accompanying Rav Popov, and Ochechuso Mahave Lachatz al Abasura Avakala Loisiv Lenadunya. And his presence, Yehuda bar Meir's presence, appears as a source of pressure on the father of the bride to increase the amount to be written into the ksuba. If that sounds a little bit abstract, of course, we're missing the details. Let's take a look now at the Gemara. Rav Papa, Yasik Le Libre, Be Abba Surah. Rav Papa was involved in helping to prepare the wedding of his son in the home of Abba Surah. Abba Surah, that is the name of the father of the Kala. Ozil Le Michtav Lo Ksubasa. He went to have the ksuba prepared. Shoma Yehuda Bar Meimar. Yehuda Bar Meimar heard about this. Nofak also Ischazi Lehi came and appeared to him, and they started walking together. Kimotu Lepischa, when they got to the door of Abba Surah, have a komiftar mine. Yehuda Bar Meimar wanted to take leave. He sought out the permission of Rav Papa to allow him, Yehuda, to go back home. Omar Lay, Rav Papa said, Nei Omar Bahadoi, come in with me. We continue at the top of Daf Nun Gimel. Chazya the lo have nichole. Rav Papa saw that Yehuda bar Meimar was uncomfortable. He didn't want to go in. Omar Lay, my daitoch. So Rav Papa says to his friend, he says, what's your concern? Mishum de Omar Lei Shmuel Rav Yehuda. Are you worried about what Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda? Shinina, he says, wise one. Lo teheve ba'avuri achsanta. Don't be present when there is transfer of property, one's property. Afilu mibra bisha lebra tova. If you happen to be aware of a father who is transferring, reassigning in anticipation of inheritance, you might say in the preparation of a will, he's assigning. He has sons of different qualities. Bra bisha, an undesirable type son, and a bra tova, good son. So Rav Yehuda is told by Shmuel, don't be present when a father is reassigning his properties from a bad son to a good son. And you know why? The lo yadia, you never know. My zara nofak mine. If the father's goal is to withhold properties because his son chose a negative way of life. But one doesn't know what kind of grandchildren will come forth from him. In other words, one has a son that chose an undesirable path of life. If you cut him out from the inheritance, you might in effect be cutting out the grandchildren from wealth, and those grandchildren themselves might be quite desirable. So you never know. You never know who's going to come forth from whom. So don't play around with your estate by assigning more to one and less to the other. And as Shmuel tells Rav Yehuda, don't be present when you see the redistribution of one's estate from one in favor of the other. V'kol shekein, and you might reason, mibra labarta, when properties are being transferred from a son to a daughter. When we said before that the laws of inheritance from the Torah standpoint say only sons inherit, daughters do not inherit. And here we're going into a house where Abba Surah apparently has sons, and he's assigning properties to his daughter in anticipation of her marriage. So is that why you're hesitating entrance because of what Shmuel told Rav Yehuda? So Rav Papa continues saying, if that's your reason, but honami takanta de rabbonani, this idea of a father transferring property from his son, in other words, anticipated property that his son would inherit eventually, and transferring it to his daughter, is also a rabbinic enactment. The Omer of Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai. That was what we featured in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, who quoted Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And if you note the Gemara back on Nun Beis Omid Beis, this is what we saw at the very. You can see we have a corresponding arrow right at the beginning of the Gemara's discussion on the Mishnah back there again on Nun Beis Omid Beis. That was we explained that we wanted to encourage men to marry women, and how does a father see to it that that takes place? By assigning properties to his, assigning a nice, generous dowry to his daughter. So, come in, says Rav Papa. Omar Lay, we continue in the Gemara. So, Yehuda Barmema says, Hani Mili Midate. That's all fine and good when the father is acting on his own. La suye nami, but to force a father to give something that he might not want to give over to his daughter, is that also desirable? Amar Lei, so Rav Papa said, Otomi ko amino loch de oil ve'asi, did I say come in and force him? Oil ve'lota say come in. I say come in and don't say anything. Don't force him. Just come in and sit quietly. Just be with me. Amar Lei, so Yehuda Bar Meima says, Maloi didi hainu asi, my mere entrance to the house, my entering with you, that itself will be a source of undue pressure, whereby the father Abu Sura will add because of my presence here, because out of honor to me, so he'll add more money to his daughter than he would have assigned otherwise. Achbe v'oil ishtik v'yosiv. Nevertheless, Rav Papa prevailed upon Yehuda Bar Meimar. He entered, remained silent, and sat down. So far, now Abu Sura sees his Mechutin's friend, says Rav Papa's friend, Yehuda Bar Meimar, sitting there, remaining silent. So far, Ihu Mirsach Rosach, and Abu Sura thought that his silence is a sign of anger. In other words, that the anger that Abu Sura is not signing enough, not writing enough into the Ksuba. So Abu Sura felt intimidated. He wrote everything that he owned to his daughter. Lesof Omar Lei, afterwards he said, Hashto Nami Lomishtoi Mar. That's Abu Sura saw that Yehuda Bar Meimar kept quiet. He says, well, you're still silent. Chai Damor Lo Shviki Midrashoi. By your life, he swore, I didn't leave for myself anything. Omar Lei, Yehuda Bar Meimar responds, Imi Noi Didi, if you would have asked me for an Eitzah, for counsel, Afilu Hai Nami De Kasvis Lo Nichol, even that which you wrote in, is I'm not comfortable with it. Omar Lei, Hashtanami Adubi, so should I now back out? It seems, if I can add my own interpretation, it seems that when Yehuda Bar Meimar says, if you would have asked me, even that which you wrote in, it seems that even that which you wrote in initially, I wasn't happy with that. Maybe, you know, it could have been less and it would have been fine too. So Abu Sura says, should I back out now? Should I subtract, reduce that which I assigned? I'm like, no, don't do that now. Shavya Nafsho Hadrano Lo Kamina. To make yourself into a hadrana. Hadrana is someone who backs out. You know, he gives and takes back. That's not a proper thing to do. I'm not suggesting that you make yourself into a hadrana. So you can see here the significance in this sukya of the ksubas bon and dikrin, and how all of this is designed to encourage marriage, encourage men to seek out wives because they're coming into the marriage with additional funds, making them more attractive as mates, and all of this in the interest of assuring the development of Jewish families, of the next generation. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.